A couple weeks ago, my family and I were watching It's the Great Pumpkin, Charlie Brown. So if you're familiar with the Charlie Brown cartoons and the comics, one of the ongoing stories in those is Charlie Brown trying to kick the football. And so Lucy, we'll loosely call her his friend, will offer the chance. She says, "Here, Charlie Brown, I'll hold the football and you can come run and kick it." Well, every single time it happens, Charlie Brown comes running, and there's the pitter-patter feet, and you see him come running, and what happens at the end? Lucy pulls the football away, and Charlie Brown goes flying through the air, screaming, and lands flat on his back. And every time I watch it, I think, don't do it, Charlie Brown. She's going to pull the football away. But Charlie Brown never seems to hear me. And every time he does it, sometimes reading the Bible feels like that. You watch a story happening, and you see people about to make a mistake. You see them about to do the wrong thing and you're yelling, say, don't do it, don't do it. But every time they do. We've been reading through the first five books of the Bible, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, the Torah, the Pentateuch, the books of Moses over the last 6 weeks and exploring these stories. And that's one of the things we see again and again is the people making bad choices. We keep thinking, well, maybe they'll make a better choice the next time, but it never seems to. And so here's where we are today at the beginning of the book of Numbers. I want to just take a brief summary of what's happened before this. So if you haven't caught up with all the reading, maybe you're new with us, what's going on? What's happened so far in the Bible? So the Bible begins in the book of Genesis. God creates the world and all is good. And he puts people in it to rule alongside him and to rule with him. But people choose their own way over his way. And this is a rebellion against God, and the world kind of spins into chaos out of that. But God has a rescue plan, a way to redeem the world, and he chooses to do that through a family. And he calls a man named Abram, whom he later names Abraham, and he says, Abraham, I'm going to make you into a great nation. I'm going to give you descendants as many as the stars in the sky and the sand on the seashore. And through you, all the nations on earth will be blessed. So God's plan is to use Abraham and his descendants and make them a nation, and he's going to give them a land to live in. And out of this land, these people will be a light to the world. Well, the rest of Genesis is the story of Abraham's family, and we see that they are people who make bad choices again and again, but God continues to remain faithful to them. The end of the book of Genesis leads us into Exodus and the continuation of the story. This family of Abraham, his descendants are now in the land of Egypt. There they become enslaved to a man named Pharaoh, the king of Egypt. And Pharaoh tries to destroy these people we call the Israelites. But God sends a rescuer, a man named Moses. And Moses leads them out of captivity. And there's all kinds of miracles. There's plagues put on the Egyptians. The waters parted. Pharaoh's army is destroyed. And God brings them out of this enslavement, leading them eventually to this land of promise. But along the way, they stop at a place called Mount Sinai. And at Mount Sinai, God gathers them together and he reminds them of all that he's done for them. He says, I'm the Lord your God who brought you up out of Egypt, out of slavery. And then he says, I want you to be my people. And because of what I've done for you, I'm going to make you into a nation, a holy nation, a nation set apart, a kingdom of priests. Not because you're special, but because I've chosen you. And then he begins to give them commandments, ways to live this life. We know things like the Ten Commandments, but the rest of Exodus and all of the book of Leviticus are these commands, instructions for how the people are to live. How the people are to live set apart from the world around them in all that they do. And one of the other instructions he gave them is instructions on how to build a tabernacle. And the tabernacle was essentially a tent, a mobile spot that was God's presence in the midst of the people. And that's where we start the book of Numbers. So they've been at Mount Sinai for a year, getting the instructions. They've been spending time there. They've been learning. And finally, it's time to get ready. Now, the book of Numbers is another one of those books. I mean, most of us wouldn't pick up a book and say, I want to read a book about numbers. Unless you're really into math or something. But the book of Numbers starts off, it's a little slow at the beginning. I'll give you that. It starts off, first couple chapters are just big, long counts of how many people are in all the different groups and tribes. And then it gets into all the names of people. And then there's these stories of, oh, and here's the offerings they brought. And you feel like you're just like on this endless repeat. And they brought 12 of this and 12 of this and 12 of this. And then the next tribe brought these things. And you think, oh my goodness. But finally, chapter 10 comes. And the action begins. They make some trumpets and they sound the trumpets and the people are ready to go. So imagine now, you're part of the people of Israel. You've been brought out of slavery. You've been sitting at this mountain for a year. God's presence has been up in the mountain. It's been great. But you know somewhere out there, there's this land you're supposed to live in. This land that God has called you and promised you and to your descendants. And you're going to go there. And finally, on one morning, the trumpets blow and it's time to set out. And they get ready to go and they arrange themselves. The tabernacle, this tent with God's presence is in the middle. And there's three tribes to the north and three to the east and three to the west and three to the south. God is at the center of what they're doing. And they start marching towards the land of promise. And we feel like, oh, this is going good. Because time and time again, and the early book of Numbers is like, and they did what God told them. And they did what God told them. And they did what God told them. So they're setting out. It's going really great for 3 days. 3 whole days from the time they set out, and then they start to complaining. They start complaining about just anything and everything, and then it's eventually the food. And they think, and what's interesting though in this story is we see them complaining, and God gets angry with them. Which, if you've ever traveled with someone, they're complaining, you can understand the anger behind it. But why it's interesting is because in the book of Exodus, the same thing sort of happened. Remember, they left slavery in Egypt and they come out and they complain about things. But we never hear about God getting angry with them. We hear of God providing for them and he provides for them here. But here we also see God getting angry. And I think why? Because a year has gone by. A year has gone by where God has been teaching them and showing them that I will take care of you. I mean, when they first came out of slavery, they didn't know what to expect from God. But he showed them all through this year and all the way along, every time they needed water, every time they needed food, God provided for them. And so they've experienced a year of this. And now, a year later, God expects them to know a little better. God expects them. And so all of a sudden, they're not just complaining, which is fair. If you're on a trip and you don't have food, if you're on a trip and you don't have water, you're going to complain. But this isn't just complaining, it's a failure to trust who God is. And this happens 7 different times in the book of Numbers. And the one we're going to look at, one that Rick read earlier, is number 4 in this midst of rebellions that are going on. So, what's the story? They've come finally, they've marched along, there's been all these complaints, different things going on. And finally they reach this land that God has promised them, hundreds of years before to their ancestor Abraham. They come to this land and they're looking out into the land and God says to Moses, I want you to send some people out into the land. And we often call them spies. I call them really witnesses. They're sent out to come back and talk about this land. And so they go into the land. There's 2 from each tribe. So they're representing all the people of Israel. They go into the tribe and they come back with good news. Oh, this land is amazing. It's flowing with milk and honey. In other words, it has all we provide. And they even bring back some grapes. And it's one of the great details. They bring back a cluster of grapes that's so big it takes 2 men carrying it on a pole between them. Well, that's a big cluster of grapes. And then it goes on. And this was their report to Moses. We entered the land you sent us to explore. It is indeed a bountiful country, a land flowing with milk and honey. Here is the kind of food it produces. It's a good land. There's a but coming. But the people living there are powerful and their towns are large and fortified. We even saw giants there, the descendants of Anak. So here they are. They're saying, yeah, it's a good land, but there's a problem. There's giants there. So this is 22 of the spies, but there's one set of these witnesses, Caleb and Joshua, who have a different take on it. And Caleb says to them, he says, that it's going to be okay. And it says, but the other men who had explored the land disagreed. We can't go up against them. They are stronger than we are. So Caleb says, we can do it. But the men say, no, we can't do it. They're stronger than we are. So you're in the community of Israel. You've got 2 of the witnesses saying, we can do this. And the other 22 saying, oh, no. There's giants there. There's no way we can do it. Who do you listen to? Well, we know what we should be doing, but people of Israel, then the whole community began weeping aloud and they cried all night. Their voices rose in a great chorus of protest against Moses and Aaron. If only we had died in Egypt or even here in the wilderness, they complained. So there they are. We were better off in Egypt. Now think about that for just a minute. They were enslaved in Egypt. They were captives. They were forced to build bricks. The Pharaoh attempted to exterminate them by killing all their young boys. But they come to this land and somebody says there's some giants there. They say, well, it would have been a whole lot better to be back in Egypt. What's going on? It's the same story. The same story we've been hearing. God has good intentions for the people, but they begin to doubt it. God says, I'm going to give you a land. And the people says, you brought us here to die. Really? Because God inflicted plagues on the Egyptians. They came to a sea. God split the sea in half. He drowned Pharaoh's army. He fed them with manna and quail. He brought water from a rock all the way through. And so he does all this stuff and they come to this land and they're like, you brought us here to die. If God had wanted them to die, he could have done it a long time before that. But they failed to trust. They're afraid. One commentator, David Stubbs, says it this way. The central rebellion and thus the central sin of Israel in Numbers is their anxious fear, which leads them to finally reject God and his plan for them. It is not a prideful rejection of God, but something else. What's that something else? They're afraid. They're afraid. And the way they fear, what happens when we're afraid? It leads to despair. And when we're afraid also, they settle for less. God has a plan. God has a plan and says, here's this incredible land, but they think their plan is better. They think, oh, but you know what? It was just better back there in Egypt. At least we knew what was going on. This is unpredictable. I don't know what is going on. And I think sometimes we think we can't relate, but we can, because the way we relate is we know God's invitation, but sometimes we see the obstacles. And so we have to ask ourselves the same sort of question. Do we believe God's intentions are good for us? When God is leading us and guiding us, do we believe what he is calling us to is good? Now, it's not easy when there are obstacles, whatever those obstacles may be, and we'll talk about that in a little bit. But what are those obstacles? It's not easy when the plans of God aren't clear. I mean, the people of Israel, they had this pillar of fire and a pillar of cloud going before them. They knew where they were supposed to go. They knew what they were supposed to do. They had been passed down for generations. This is what God is going to do. They were at Mount Sinai and they heard the voice of God thundering on the mountain, giving them instructions what to do. Moses came down with a set of tablets engraved by the finger of God, telling them what to do. I wish I had that sometimes. I wish sometimes in my daily choices there was a pillar of cloud, a pillar of fire going like, oh, that's what I'm supposed to do. But I don't have that. But here, what do the people choose? They choose despair. They fail to trust. They're not sure that God really longs the best for them. They see the obstacles. They see the challenges. They see that this is going to be hard. Or at least in their mind, it's going to be hard. So what happens next? God says to them, fine. You don't want to enter the land, you won't enter the land. You say it would be better if we had died in the wilderness? That's exactly what's going to happen. And so what God says is, you're going to wander in the wilderness for 40 years. You didn't like that little short trip across the desert? Try 40 years on for size. And all this generation, except for Caleb and Joshua, who didn't think you could enter the land, you're all going to die in the desert. And if we just stop there, I think we miss something, because there's something else that goes on in the story. One of the things we see is there are consequences to the rebellion, but there's more to the story. And I want us to look at what else happens in the story, because I think that's where the key lesson is for about who God is and our life with him. First, if we read a little farther in the story, Numbers 14, 20. Then the Lord said, I will pardon them as you have requested. So Moses had gone to God and said, God, you got to understand, these people, they make some bad choices. Would you forgive them? And God says, yeah, I'll forgive them. And this is incredible. Even after all this time, even after all these things that God has done, when the people rebel, God forgives them. He's faithful and has a purpose for them. Now, there are still consequences, and we have to sort those two things out. But we have to realize that God still forgives them. Even after this outright rebellion, even after this year of teaching them and training them, they refuse to listen. They don't do what God asks, and God forgives them. And so we have to keep that in mind, that that's the nature of who God is. And there are the consequences. They spend the 40 years in the desert. God could have killed them on the spot, but he doesn't. But the second thing I want us to notice is, what does he do with them at the moment? Because again, if you imagine, they've rebelled and God says, I'm going to let you wander in the desert for 40 years and you're going to die and not enter the land. Wouldn't it have been a whole easier to just kill them right then and there and get into the land? But he doesn't do that. Instead, they wander for the desert for 40 years. We're going to skip ahead a little bit in the story here to the book of Deuteronomy, which we're going to do in the next couple weeks. But I want to read a little bit of that, because in the book of Deuteronomy, that takes place where Moses and the people are now ready. 40 years goes by. There's a gap between the end of Numbers and the beginning of Deuteronomy. 40 years goes by. They're ready to enter the land. The new generation is there. And Moses is talking to this new generation and reminding them of all that God has done. And he tells them this. He says, remember how the Lord your God led you through the wilderness for these 40 years. So this is after the 40 years of wandering goes by. Humbling you and testing you to prove your character and to find out whether or not you would obey his commands. He says, yes, he humbled you by letting you go hungry and then feeding you with manna, a food previously unknown to you and your ancestors. He did it to teach you that people do not live by bread alone. Rather, we live by every word that comes from the mouth of the Lord. And he says, for all these 40 years, your clothes didn't wear out and your feet didn't blister or swell. Think about it, he says. Just as a parent disciplines a child, the Lord your God disciplines you for your own good. So God has taken them into the wilderness, and what you see is he did it to teach them, to help them to understand who he is, because in a sense, the people, the first generation, they hadn't learned the lesson yet. And so God is patient. He says, I'm going to teach you the lesson, and he uses this wandering in the wilderness. And the thing about the wilderness, it became a shorthand, it became a metaphor, it became an image used in much of the rest of the Bible as about how God takes people to shape them. We see even in their life of Jesus. Jesus, shortly after his baptism, immediately after his baptism, he says, what does he do? He goes into where? The wilderness. To be tested. We're going to come back to that a little bit. And it's imagery used by followers of Jesus all through the ages to talk about a time of wilderness. And the wilderness is a place where God tests us and trains us. We say, why wilderness? What's so significant about the wilderness? Because in the wilderness, you got nothing. You know, when you're in the city, there's all the amenities. There's the food. There's the market down there. There's the well. There's everything. You go in the wilderness, you got one thing to depend on, and that's God. And so the wilderness becomes this picture of saying, God's going to help us and shape us and mold us into the people that we need. So Moses tells them, you were in the desert. You didn't have food. God provided for you. Your shoes didn't wear out. 40 years and their shoes didn't wear out. I can't get a pair to last 6 months. They went 40 years. They walked for 40 years without blisters. I mean, how many people go on a hiking thing and like after 2 days, you've got blisters all year? 40 years. And so God is what? He's providing for them. He's caring for them. And he's teaching them and training them what? That he will take care of them. They're there in the desert and they're thinking, oh, but he's saying, no, I've got you. I've got you. So for us today, how do these stories reflect us today? Because we don't have a land we're going into. We're not facing down giants. But I think what it can do is it can remind us of the challenge of following Jesus. So again, back to David Stubbs, he says this. He says, the cross itself is the symbolic center of the faithfulness that eluded Israel. Instead of fearing for his life and avoiding and rejecting the call of God, Christ entered into his own place of rest at the right hand of God through enduring the cross. So what's Stubbs getting at? What's the story getting at here is following Jesus in many ways like the people of Israel looking at that land. Looking at that land and asking the question, the land looks challenging. It's unknown. It's filled with difficulties. And then there's this old life. I know that and I know what that's like. It's coming to that point of saying, I can't do that. I want to go back to my old life. And so we think of, again, I mentioned the story. Jesus goes into the desert and is tempted. And he faces three temptations the Gospels tell us about. The first one, he's in the desert there, and the tempter, the Satan, his opponent comes to him and says this. He says, backstory. Jesus is there 40 days, 40 nights. He's fasting, which means he's not eating anything. So we're guessing he's probably kind of hungry at this point. So the tempter comes to him, Satan comes to him and says, see that rock there? You can turn it into a loaf of bread. You're the Son of God. And so what's the temptation? To use God for your own desires. To use God to fulfill your needs, to fulfill your things, to focus on our physical needs. And Jesus responds with that verse we read from Deuteronomy, man does not live by bread alone. And so the temptation in the Christian life is sometimes to depend on God merely as a source to fulfill all our physical needs. The temptation is we can use him to take care of all our things, to make sure that our needs are taken care of. What's more uncertain is to say, I'm going to follow Jesus and I'm not sure what's going to happen. The other part of it is the next temptation. He takes him and he says to him, he takes him to this highest point in the temple and he says, leap off and the angels will take care of you. And what is it? It's a temptation to bend God to do our own will, to use God to simply as a protection for us, to rely on for safety. And God never promises that kind of thing. And so the call to follow Jesus is a call to enter the unknown and the uncertainty and to wonder, what is God going to do? When Jesus comes to the end of his life and he's facing the cross, he knows he could call down angels to rescue him. He knows that he could be saved. But he says, no, not what I want, but what you want, God. And so like the people of Israel standing and looking in that land and not sure what's going on, they're wondering, God, do you have my best in mind? Sometimes when we're called to follow Jesus, we wonder, does God have my best intentions in mind? What does God want for me? Because that sounds really hard, what he's asking me to do. Because he's asking me, Jesus says, I want you to bless your enemy. I want you to pray for those who persecute you. I want you to be meek. I want you to be humble. I want you to give up. I want you to lay down your life. And we think, I want to go back to my old life because that was a whole lot easier. Third temptation of Jesus was the temptation to use power. He says, Satan takes him. He says, I will give you all the kingdoms of the world if you bow down and worship me. It's a temptation to use the way of power to rule, the way of power to bring about our means. And Jesus always says, it's not about power. He criticizes the disciples. He says, that's not the way I've called you to live. It's a whole lot easier. In the world we live in today, it's often a quest for power that if we're just in charge, if we can do it, then we can make things the right way. And Jesus shows us the way to follow him is by taking up a cross and dying. The way to follow him, the way of Jesus, is giving up rights, not seizing our rights. And so when we're standing at that border and we're looking and saying, Jesus calls me to give up my rights, there's a temptation to look back and say, I want to go back to Egypt where I could like seize my rights. But the invitation is to follow him and to trust him. Now it's easier said than done. I mean, so many of these, we read the stories of Jesus and all the calls and the letters in the New Testament, we read about what it looks like to follow Jesus, and it's hard. And it's easy to stand up and say, well, I'm going to do that. And the truth is, sometimes we fail. And that's where the story continues. Because as we think about what happened in this story, remind ourselves, when Israel failed, what happened? They went into wandering and there were consequences, but what else? God forgave them, right? Because we read that earlier. And reassured them of his faithfulness, Numbers 15. Then the Lord told Moses, give the following. This is just right after they've decided not to enter the land and the people said, oh, we're not going to do it. Just after God has said, you're going to wander in the desert for 40 years. Then the Lord told Moses, give the following instructions to the people of Israel. When you finally settle in the land I am giving you. God has already said, I'm going to keep my promise. He doesn't say, when the people get it all straight, I'm going to give you the land. What does he say? He says, I'm going to give you that land because I made a promise to you. And so we're reminded of God's faithfulness, of how he worked with them and how he shaped them. And that's where that wilderness, going back to the wilderness, is God didn't just tell them to get better. And sometimes we feel it's a temptation within the church, which God's just wanting me to be better. But God doesn't just tell us to get better. He's the one who works to make us who he calls us to be. He trains them. He took them in the desert for a purpose, to make them into who he's called them to be. And so when God not only calls them and us to be set apart, he's the one who forms us. He uses the desert. He uses those trials. And so the desert, again, this is a picture that's often been used in Christian history through to describe the life. Another term sometimes used is the dark night of the soul. And the picture of it is God takes us into these places where we're forced to rely on him. And so, for example, this dark night of the soul, the idea is something like this. That oftentimes when we first become Christians or in different phases of our lives, everything is exciting and new. We're reading our Bible and we're like, oh, this is so good. I'm just getting all these things. I'm singing songs and I feel the presence and the power of God. I feel all these things going on and I'm experiencing this. And then sometimes what God will do is he'll take away those feelings. Where all of a sudden you pick up your Bible, you're like, I'm not getting anything here. You come to church on a Sunday morning and your lips are moving, but there's nothing going on inside. And maybe you don't even feel like singing at the moment. Maybe you go to your time of prayer and you feel like, oh, there's just nothing. I don't know what to say. I'm not sure God is listening. And the temptation often is to think it's something wrong with us. That, oh, the songs aren't doing it for me. I need to find some new songs. Well, the Bible's not doing it for me, so I need to find a new reading plan, or I need to find a new translation. I'm not getting it, so maybe I'm just listening to the wrong podcast or watching the wrong teacher. Maybe I need to find a different church, because then I'll recover that what's going on in God in my life, and I'll feel that excitement, that joy that I once felt. Those are possibilities. The other possibility is God is doing it to you. And you think, well, why would God do that to me? Why would God take away that joy and that excitement? Because God wants you to understand it's not about the feeling of reading the Bible. What God wants is you to love him. And sometimes what we get in the Christian life is we fall in love with the trappings, the experience. We fall in love. I love the singing. I love the music. I love the preaching. And God says, that's great, but what I want you to love is me. And so God takes away all those feelings. He leads you into the wilderness and he wants to say, okay, when you have none of that, when you don't have the songs, when you don't have those great feelings, when you don't have the incredible preaching, when you don't have whatever those things are, do you still love me? And do you still want only me? And that's what he does with the Israelites, and that's what he does with us oftentimes. So what we can do is in those moments, if it comes to you when you feel like I'm not feeling the joy anymore, stop for a moment and ask yourself, is this God leading me into this time? Is God bringing me into a wilderness? Because what happens in the wilderness, we come out the other side stronger and better. Well, nobody thinks the wilderness is fun. I'm not saying, oh, like it's an amusement park filled with rainbows and unicorns and stuff like, oh, everybody should go to the wilderness. I don't want to give you a false sale on it. But what I can tell you is when you've gone through the wilderness, when you've gone through those times where you feel like, I'm not sure what's going on, and when you find yourself in the wilderness and all you have to cling to is God, you will come out the other side stronger and more in love with who he is. And that's what God did with the people of Israel. It's what he does with us. Because his goal is to make us love him more. His goal is to make us into faithful people. He doesn't just say, be faithful, and then leave us to run off on our own and figure it out. God says, I'm going to help you. I'm going to train you. Just like, in that picture he said, just like a father trains his children. Or we could say a mother trains her children. Parents, you can have that task of simply saying to your kids, well, I want you to do this, and hope they figure it out. You can hand them the keys and say, go ahead, go drive. But wouldn't it be better if you taught them how to drive first? Or to do whatever task it is. And so when God says, I want you to be a holy people, I want you to be shaped in a way in which you are fully dependent on me, I want you to be a people who live separately from the rest of the world, I want you to be a people who give up power, I want you to be a people who love your enemies, I want you to be a people who bless those who persecute you, I want you to be a people who are humble, who are filled with love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, and gentleness, and self-control. I want you to be that kind of people. God doesn't just throw us out the door and hope we can do it. God instead trains and forms us through himself, his power of his Holy Spirit to do that. And sometimes that involves going through the wilderness. But it's all part of God's calling for us. He shapes us into wholeness because we can't do it ourselves. And so what God does is he strips away all that we rely on apart from God. And so we go back to that, where he says, yes, he humbled you by letting you go hungry and then feeding you with manna, a food previously unknown to you and your ancestors. He did it to teach you that people do not live by bread alone. Rather, we live by every word that comes from the mouth of the Lord. A reminder that all that we have is there. So the Israelites didn't stay in the wilderness. That's the good part of the story. I mean, the story is we don't end up in, and nor are we meant to stay in the wilderness. But God will bring us through it and work in us. In the New Testament, Paul says to the church in Philippi, and I am certain that God who began the good work within you will continue his work until it is finally finished on the day when Christ Jesus returns. That's what God was doing with the people of Israel. He was beginning a work to make them into his faithful people. And he's doing the same thing with us. And I want us to remember what Paul says and to believe that. That we'd be certain that God who began the good work in you, that when God saved you, when he brought you to Jesus, he was beginning a work in you. And he will continue that work and he will finish it on the day when Jesus returns. So my question for us is, are you at the edge? Are you ready to take the step? Or are you in the wilderness being tested and shaped? But wherever we are, God is here. God is there inviting us to draw nearer, to trust in him, to not settle for less. We fail and he forgives. And he is working in me and in you to make you like Jesus, who is the faithful one.